morning. United States versus Crowder.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Jason Steele. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Crowder. In Mr. Crowder's case below, five errors occurred. First, Mr. Crowder moved to suppress evidence based upon his Fourth Amendment rights as an expectation of privacy in a car that was submitted to a warrantless search absent exigent circumstances, which was denied by the trial court. Second, Mr. Crowder and the government jointly moved to continue the trial, and without any justification other than fear that Mr. Crowder might file more briefs or more motions, the trial court denied that continuance.
Is that what the trial court said?
It did, in fact, say that in the record, Your Honor. The third error occurred when the government failed to put forth sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Crowder of the two crimes charged in the indictment, which were under 21 U.S.C. 846, conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute greater than 500 grams of cocaine and 80 pounds of marijuana, and attempted possession of same. The evidence presented showed that Mr. Crowder traveled to Arizona with some money in his pocket. It showed that Mr. Crowder made some phone calls, and it showed that Mr. Crowder was at the scene of a crime. None of these things established the necessary evidence or the causal links to sufficiently convict Mr. Crowder beyond a reasonable doubt. Fourth, when the court entered its conviction, instead of looking to the indictment under Section 846, it instead, because of the closing arguments made by counsel regarding the elements of possession and references to the intent to possess, entered a conviction for possession under 841A rather than 846, resulting in a constructive amendment. And the fifth error that we note in our briefs was at sentencing, where Mr. Crowder was elevated to a career offender based upon two prior convictions for delivery of cocaine or narcotic, which under Illinois law is a more broadly defined crime than it is under its federal counterpart, and therefore is not, based upon the definition, sufficient to elevate one to a career offender. Turning back to the first error, the Fourth Amendment argument, critical to the case is a controlled delivery of a Ford Mustang. The Ford Mustang contained the drugs at issue in this case. The car was being transported from Tucson, Arizona to Harvey, Illinois, and the driver of that was on a tractor trailer. His name was Mr. Stouffer. Mr. Stouffer was receiving phone calls about another car on that tractor trailer, and because of those concerns, the concerns of the phone calls, he called local officers. He pulled over in Missouri, and they inspected that car with a dog. The dog alerted to that car, and drugs were found in that car eventually. At that point, the officers asked Mr. Stouffer, "Did you have any other concerns with cars on this tractor trailer?" And Mr. Stouffer's response was, "Well, I kind of do about this Ford Mustang. It looks a little strange." And at that point, without a warrant, without asking Mr. Stouffer to open the car and get in and look around, instead, the officers, without a warrant, without fear of flight, went into the car, pulled open the seat, and found drugs.
If he didn't object to that, then it was clear that he was allowing the police to look in that Mustang, wasn't it?
I'm not sure that's enough under both Seventh Circuit law as well as the case we cited,
well,
Fifth Circuit.
If the car is entrusted to him and he has dominion and control over the car at that time and he consents, I don't see the issue there.
I think if we turn to the cases such as U.S. versus Villarreal in the Fifth Circuit, as well as some of the less on point but generally discussed cases in the Seventh Circuit about packages, the authority to consent comes typically from a waiver or a form signed, for example, in the FedEx cases, where you sign a waiver that says, "I understand I'm giving control to the shipper."
Well, there's no question he was giving control, was there?
Limited control, I agree.
Well, limited control was he had entire control of the car for a long distance.
But if you look at the case law that discusses who can consent, in the case of...
I wasn't talking about the case law at that stage of the game. I was simply talking about the factual situation. The factual situation is they turned the car over to the driver of the van. They said, "Take it someplace."
And I would...
It's yours. We don't hang around watching it. It's yours.
I would respectfully submit they were given control but not authority to consent,
well,
as
if,
the case
if
is
I
holding.
Get my car to Judge Bauer to use for a week and he gets stopped by police,
I'll
can
give
certainly,
nobody permission for anything.
He wouldn't do it. Judge Keeney would give consent. But the point is that he has the authority to give that kind of consent. I've lost my dominion and control over the car, my standing to object.
There's something different between, I would argue, respectfully, Your Honor, it's something different between giving someone access, the ability to drive and utilize your vehicle, as compared to shipping a vehicle, which gives you two, basically...
Who drove the car onto the...
Mr. Stouffer did. And I guess it's notable, I have to add to that.
And he were going to drive it off, he was going to drive it off, too.
That is correct. He did drive it off, eventually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that I would say that's the access he's allowed. He's allowed to drive it on. He also inspected the car before he drove it on and noted nothing unusual. He didn't call the officers then.
Well, he thought it was unusual. He just didn't think there was anything that he was going to call the cops about then. But he did note something unusual because he told the police he thought it was something funny about the car.
He mentioned that in Missouri, so several days later. But
now,
I
would assume you noticed that before Missouri, he's the guy to pull the car in there.
The record doesn't support that, I don't think. I mean, if he did, you would assume if he was that concerned, he would have called like he did about the other car where there was a dog.
I'd say he was that concerned, but I asked him, yeah, anything else you're concerned about? He said, yeah, I'm concerned about that. And that concern didn't bubble up at the moment he said it. I mean, it was when he pulled the car in and he noticed all these things. Right?
And I would submit that had Mr. Stouffer gotten into the car and opened the door and let the officers in, we'd have a different case.
How did the officers get him?
They opened the door and they pulled open the seat. It sounds like I'm making a difference without a distinction, but it's a giant distinction. And the Supreme Court law and Jacobson.
How is it a giant distinction? He has the keys. The door is unlocked. He raises no objection to them looking in the car.
And this
he calls
goes back,
their attention to the fact that there's something funny about it, and they open the car and look.
And that goes back to the cases that I think that the Jacobson cases, as well as the distinction of the cases cited by the government, which is that if the owner, the shipping company, first inspects it and sees something internally that causes it concern, such as in the case of the shipping the M16 rifle with the pin sticking out, or the case where the drugs are literally visible to the shipper. Then in those cases, absolutely. They can then allow the officer, because they have concern about what they're shipping. If you look at the U.S. versus Villarreal case out of the Fifth Circuit, I can't find a distinction from that case, and I don't think my colleague could either. You're talking about two canisters that are being shipped across the country in a similar situation. They were loaded by the shipper. The person receiving had a bill of lading with a fictitious name, and the government, rather than allowing the shipper to open the package, themselves opened it. And the court found that that was an improper search, and it held that suppression of the evidence was correct. And that should have been the decision in this case. On the second issue, which is the failure to continue the trial at the request of both not only Mr. Crowder but the government, here the government on the day of trial disclosed an expert, disclosed some conversations that it had the night before with some of its witnesses, as well as some voluminous phone records, to defense counsel, at which point defense counsel argued to the trial court below that he didn't feel he'd be sufficiently prepared to present cross-examinations of these witnesses. He also didn't feel like he was prepared strategically to enter into the trial. And the government agreed and requested the court grant the continuance. Instead, the court said the defendant, strangely, had a right to a speedy trial, despite the fact that he was the one who wanted the continuance, and denied it. And again, I don't have it in front of me. I could quote it on rebuttal if necessary, but the court said he was afraid that that Mr. Crowder would file more motions and more briefs.
What stage of the trial did this happen?
The first day of trial, before it started. It was before opening arguments had occurred.
After the jury was sworn?
There was no jury. There was waived in this case. There are factors that need to be looked at under U.S. versus Miller. The court recognized those factors, but didn't cite to or identify any factor he was relying upon. And in recent Seventh Circuit decision, the U.S. versus Williams case, which was entered into Westlaw, although decided before my reply brief, but entered into Westlaw the day after, this court found that where there is no justification under factors such as Miller, but where there should have been a continuance, it should have been granted, and it was there. The third argument goes to the sufficiency of the evidence. Here, this is, to me at least, a critical case of piling inference upon inference. If you look at the, and the best way to look at it, for me at least, is to juxtapose our case to the cases cited by the government. In each one of those cases, and they cite U.S. versus Moser, U.S. versus Gauges, and U.S. versus Domes, there are specific facts, although circumstantial, but specific facts showing people actually in places where drugs are located are talking about drugs, are tying money to drugs. There is none of that evidence here, not an iota of it. There is money in Mr. Crowder's pocket, and there is him at the scene of the crime. Respectfully, neither of those things justify and can support a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. I see I'm entering my rebuttal time. At this point, I would reserve the rest of my argument unless the court has further questions.
Thank you. Your Honors, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tinos Dimitatos, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the United States. The district court did not err in denying Mr. Crowder's motion to suppress. My colleague asked me to differentiate the Villarreal case out of the Fifth Circuit. Here's how Villarreal is different. Villarreal deals with sealed drums. In this case, we have a vehicle that's unlocked, that's given to a third party, that's given to a third party with keys to the vehicle, and is asked to ship the car from Tucson, Arizona, all the way up to Harvey, Illinois. Those facts are not analogous to the facts in Villarreal. The Mustang in this case is not a sealed drum or a sealed container. That was clear from the facts of the case. It was clear once the keys were turned over to the driver of the tractor trailer in Tucson, Arizona. It was clear from the bill of lading that the driver had to have unfettered access via the keys, via any type of alarm system that may be on the car. That was clear on its face. As such, there could be no reasonable expectation of privacy. Further, the issue of consent. At the time that the driver of the tractor trailer stopped at the way station and spoke to the members of the Missouri Highway Patrol, he wasn't working for the government. He was simply a concerned citizen doing his job and doing a good job of filling in police on suspicious circumstances. He's the one that took initiative to contact police in the first instance, and once he pulled over, he told them about concerns that he was having about a Pontiac Grand Prix. Missouri Highway Patrol responded to that. They had a trained canine unit on scene. They inspected that car after a positive dog sniff. Once the canine unit left the area, the driver was then asked if any other vehicles caused suspicion. And as you mentioned, Your Honor, Judge Bauer, these suspicions were clear from the testimony of Mr. Stauffer at trial that it was odd to him when the two Hispanic gentlemen in Tucson, Arizona, dropped off this Ford Mustang. Mr. Stauffer said they got the heck out of there very quickly. They didn't wait for me to watch me put their vehicle, their prized possession, so to speak, on my tractor trailer, which typically everybody does. And all the other suspicious circumstances that he noticed in Tucson. He filled in Missouri Highway Patrol about it. Missouri Highway Patrol asked him to unload the vehicle. They didn't do it themselves. That's a key distinction. Mr. Stauffer agreed. Mr. Stauffer removed the vehicle, and right there is the consent. So there could be no Fourth Amendment claim by Mr. Crowder, and the district court properly denied his motion to suppress evidence. The court certainly did not commit clear error in not suppressing Mr. Crowder, the evidence against Mr. Crowder. With regard to the second issue, the continuance motion, the government agreed to the continuance in fairness to the defendant. But what's key here isn't just that the defendant moved for a continuance and the government said we have no objection to that and maybe a few days would be advisable in this case. The focus is the colloquy that was exchanged between the defendant and the defense attorney in this case and Judge Norgal at the time when Judge Norgal was deciding whether or not to grant the continuance. This court has held there can't simply be vague assertions. And that's what we have here, Your Honors. Admittedly, the preparation time for trial, new facts came to the government's attention. As soon as those facts came to the government's attention, they were tendered to defense counsel promptly. The government made representations that the confession, so to speak, or the post-arrest inculpatory conduct that came to the government's attention pretty close to trial would not be used by the government. That being said, in fairness to defense counsel, when he asked for a continuance, we said, of course, we won't object.
I was curious about that. If there was a new trial, would his statements be admissible at the second trial?
Judge, we were in the position where our case in chief, as we decided to put it forward before what we knew was going to be a bench trial, was going to be Mr. Crowder and Mr. Watkins' travel to Dallas, Texas in the month of January with large sums of money on Mr. Crowder. And then without Mr. Watkins as a witness, our evidence was going to focus then on the controlled delivery, the events leading up to the controlled delivery, with the driver explaining how he came into contact with Missouri Highway Patrol, how the drugs were found, and then the video and audio of the controlled delivery. And by the way, Your Honors, that was the key evidence in this case, and that was given to Mr. Crowder back at the time of his arraignment. That was the key evidence in this case. Now, a confession has been called the mother of all evidence. Would the government seek to use it at some subsequent trial? Potentially, yes. But we were faced with a position where we learned very close to the trial date that there was this new information, and what's key is it wasn't exculpatory. It was inculpatory. It was obviously worse for Mr. Crowder.
He was cooperating, wasn't he?
That's exactly right, Judge.
So
and Mr.
if the case was sent back for a new trial, would it go back with the government not only having all the evidence it already had, have this in addition?
That's exactly right. The government decided not to use a huge piece of evidence against Mr. Crowder.
When did you discover the inculpatory statement?
Once the phone records came back, Your Honor, the Sprint Nextel was subpoenaed. We received the phone records on the Friday evening prior to trial. Trial was set for the following Tuesday morning. In reviewing the phone records, and defense counsel at the time had no issue with us introducing the phone records. This was something that he was going to also use at the trial.
Why did you advise Judge Norgel that you weren't going to use that?
The colloquy was this. We talked to Mr. Samuels to put it into context and said, we noticed that calls were made after the controlled delivery. We were trying to figure out how that happened, and we noticed a very key area code in this case, a Tucson, Arizona area code, 520. We spoke with DEA, and DEA advised us that, yeah, on a car ride, he decided to try to help himself out and call his source of supply. Obviously, very inculpatory type statements. We called Mr. Samuels, advised him of the nature of that, told him admittedly that it wasn't reduced to a report, as it should have been, but nonetheless it wasn't, and that we wouldn't. At that point, Mr. Samuels said, well, I'm going to move for a continuance. We said we have no objection. Tuesday morning, we appeared before Judge Norgel. And this is what's key. The colloquy between Mr. Samuels and Judge Norgel, understandably so, Mr. Samuels didn't want to get up and say, Judge, I found out that my client confessed the other day, so I need some more time. Mr. Samuels is very, I hate to use the word cryptic, but the colloquy is clear. Judge Norgel asks him, what's the secret here? He asked him that, and it's in the record. Mr. Samuels says, Your Honor, the question is the timing of the disclosures. The matters that were brought to my attention in my discussions with the government counsel yesterday are significant matters that I first learned of yesterday afternoon. The court responds, well, what's the secret here? What have you learned? That's what's key. Judge Norgel's trying to find out, based on the factors set out by this court, should I grant this continuance or not? Tell me what's going on. Now, understandably, maybe Mr. Samuels was reluctant in light of the fact that the case was postured as a bench trial. But nonetheless, a Supreme Court in Rivera versus Harris has said in bench trials, judges routinely hear inadmissible evidence that they are presumed to ignore when making decisions. So that's what's key. If Mr. Samuels would have said, Judge, here's what the government turned over specifically, here's what they've told me about that evidence, and here's what they've represented to me they're going to do with it, then we'd be in a different position here. Now, the government certainly didn't want to interject and tell Judge Norgel something about Mr. Samuels' client, which was negative to him.
Then you never used that evidence.
That's exactly right. The post-arrest conduct.
What's the harm?
That's exactly right. There was no prejudice to Mr. Crowder. Of the disclosures that were made in the days leading up to trial, there was one audio cassette that had two phone calls that were between the driver and Mr. Watkins, not Mr. Crowder. And that was introduced at trial simply to corroborate what the driver said about his contact with the defendant and his co-defendant at the time, Mr. Watkins, leading up to Harvey. So that's what's key. Judge Norgel didn't, based on what he had before him, there were vague and conclusory assertions by Mr. Samuels asking for a continuance. And second, as Your Honor points out, there was no prejudice to Mr. Crowder. We went forward. We made no mention of any type of post-arrest inculpatory conduct on the part of Mr. Crowder. The phone records that were introduced at trial, were redacted to not show any type of contact with Tucson, Arizona. We put our case before Judge Norgel as we planned on, absent this information. So there was no error. There was certainly no abuse of discretion by the district court in denying Mr. Crowder's motion The evidence that was presented against him was the same evidence as he knew it back when he got his discovery in 2006. I'll be brief with regards to my response to defendant's sufficiency argument. Judge Norrie was in the best position to decide that. In fact, this case is in a postured as a bench trial. This court has insight into what the trier of fact thought about the evidence. Typically in a jury trial, the jury will come back with either guilty or not guilty, and unless there are some type of special verdict forms, there typically is an additional insight. Here, it's a bench trial, so we have the trier of fact characterizing the evidence as overwhelming. So while Mr. Crowder may feel that the evidence was circumstantial and that all it shows was him traveling with some sum of money and that he showed up to pick up a car with his buddy in Tucson, in Harvey, respectfully, that's not all the evidence showed. In fact, it was the circumstantial evidence, the links in this case, the fact that they were so concerned, they being Mr. Crowder and Mr. Watkins, about the vehicle arriving, the fact that on the video, Mr. Crowder is the one that pulled out the pink bill of lading, the exact copy that was given to the two gentlemen in Tucson who had dropped off the vehicle. The fact that it was Mr. Crowder that gave the money to Mr. Watkins for the car. The fact that the driver says, which one of you is Andrew Thomas? A fake name. Mr. Watkins says, oh, that's me. The defendant can't be heard correcting his friend or saying, wait a second, I thought we were just here to pick up your Ford Mustang. Why are you giving him a fake name? It was the circumstantial evidence, it was the videotape and the audio tape of the controlled delivery that showed the defendants acting very suspicious. This happened across the street from the Harvey Police Department, and what's clear on the video is the entire time the driver of the tractor trailer is trying to get the Mustang off the car, both defendants are repeatedly looking around, looking at the police department. The minute the Mustang comes off, the two are seen literally punching each other, high-fiving each other, and they got in the car and left very, very, very quickly. Mr. Watkins getting in the Mustang, Mr. Crowder getting back into the Ford Taurus, which was left running during the entire time they were picking up the vehicle. That's what Judge Norgel had to make his findings of fact and conclusions of law. He determined that Mr. Crowder was guilty on both counts, conspiracy and attempted possession. Your Honors, respectfully, if there aren't any other questions, the government would rest on its brief and ask respectfully that this court affirm the conviction and sentence of Mr. Crowder. Thank you.
You have 4 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, just a clerical point. Mr. Diamantado has mentioned that there's no clear error on the Fourth Amendment issue, but for the matter of law, it's the noble review by this court, not clear error. Turning back to the issue of the authority and the removing the car from the tractor trailer, Mr. Stouffer did. One of the cases cited by the government is a case called U.S. versus Mendoza, which cites a case called U.S. versus Matlock, a U.S. Supreme Court case. And it talks about the ability to authorize a government to look into someone else's or a shared property or article is this. Common authority, quote, rests on a mutual use by persons generally having joint access or control. In the cases cited by the government, those are situations like apartments or a car loaned by a stepfather to his stepson. These are not situations where you're giving it to a common carrier like in U.S. versus Villarreal. On the sufficiency of the evidence, it was made a big deal was made at trial, and I don't have the benefit of having been there, but I have seen the video, and I can tell you that the representations, to me at least, aren't accurate. The parties are jovial during the entire communications. They, in fact, make a joke with the driver early on about going to Detroit to pick up some women. They're perhaps looking around. They are across the street from a police station, which, again, seems awful odd for two people engaged in some sort of criminal enterprise to decide to pick up a car across from a police station. So I don't see the facts of the actual drop-off being that conclusory to justify a reasonable doubt in this case. I mentioned in my opening, and it wasn't addressed by the government, but I do want to close with it, which is there are five errors in this case, three of which require reversal of the convictions. The constructive amendment, which I haven't talked about, and if Your Honors have questions, I'm happy to address it, would require reversal of simply the possession, as that's what was entered as the conviction in this case. The sentencing issue, which involves the delivery, as I mentioned, would require a vacate the sentence below. But as I addressed before, the Fourth Amendment and the sufficiency of the evidence arguments, I believe, clearly require reversal of the convictions in this case. If the Court has no further questions, I would rest on my brief.
Thank you, Counsel.
You're appointed, weren't you?
Yes, and we have the appreciation of the Court for your vigorous representation of your client in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The case will be taken under advisement.